Hello, everyone. Welcome. This is the first broadcast of the Impatient with Desire Pre-Pub Book Club. If you if you're not already signed up for the book club, which we are hosting as a group platform on Goodreads.com, feel free to give us a call at 213-623-1773 or email us at info@rarebirdlit.com, and we'll get you all signed up. This is technically a private group until March 15th, and then we're going to open it up public for everybody. And so this is a broadcast that we're starting that we'll probably be doing about once a week that will allow all the members of the book club and people beyond that to hopefully get together and discuss the book and any of the topical things. And today we have the author, Gabrielle Burton, on the line, along with her daughter, Gabrielle Burton, as well. And in the future, I think we're going to bring on some pretty interesting guests, possibly some researchers, a few enthusiastic book club members that are interested in getting their ideas out and asking questions themselves. So if you want to call into the show, the number is 626-414-3413, and definitely urge you to join, whether you're part of the group or not. Feel free to give us a call. Let us know your thoughts. So anyway, I want to introduce our guests today officially. The author of Impatient with Desire, which is our book club pick here. The Lost Journal of Tamsin Donner, released by Voice Hyperion. And the paperback comes out March 15th. Gabrielle's also the author of I'm Running Away from Home, But I'm Not Allowed to Cross the Street, and Heartbreak Hotel, as well as the memoir, Searching for Tamsin Donner. Gabrielle, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Oh, great. Well, also great. We did see yesterday you posted a very nice welcome comment and a little story about a number of things. Survival brought up the cannibalism point and how it's the least interesting part of this story, which you know, I think a lot of people, when they think of the Donner Party, that's what they think of. But that's not what your book is about, right?
No, it really isn't. It's about endurance in adversity, and it's hope, and it's about a family, particularly the Donner family, although mm-hmm. there were 81 pioneers there. And the cannibalism was just a natural progression of diminishing resources. And it's a pity that people just stop there, because what's really, really interesting and a mystery and fascinating is how people survived 4.5 months basically in a yurt underground mm-hmm. with nothing to eat.
Wow. And I mean, when you say people stop there, I mean, how many other groups were in similar circumstances? I mean, the Donner Party was pretty unique because of the early winter and whatnot. Or, I mean, are there a number of stories that we're just not hearing about because the word didn't get out?
There are. Theirs is the most dramatic, I think, because it's really the American dream gone nightmare. But mm-hmm. there are a lot of incredible pioneer stories, particularly the people who went to Oregon. A lot of them just suffered tremendously getting there. And the Mormons, too,
yeah.
Have fantastic stories. And many, many people paid the price for the West to be open. And
mm-hmm.
that's one of the things that I'm very interested in, that we honor those people and remember them.
Yeah, and I mean... Go ahead.
I was just going to pipe in. This is the younger Gabrielle, the daughter. And I actually have been reading my daughter a children's book called Roughing It on the Oregon Trail by Diane Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting because it's just a children's book about kids who travel in time back to an ancestor who was on the Oregon Trail. And yet it's pointing out how universal an experience it was for these people kicking off, that they start with these beautiful scenes of pastures and open prairie, and then as the wagon trains move along, they're walking basically, as Mom says, 2,000 miles across the country, and they think it's hard, but it just gets harder and harder and harder as they sort of inevitably run out of food and have to be gathering things along the way if they can find it, and yet the territory becomes so strange and foreign, including weather, you know, rain and snow and mountains, and then and then having to bring their oxen and wagons over landscapes that is extremely inhospitable to that kind of traveling. And I think that that's something that I would say, Mom, in the novel A Patient with Desire, you do so beautifully, is bring people into that journey along with these people. It's not something where it's at arm's length. It is, you know, you're in an armchair reading it, luckily. But it's so personal, and then it starts making sense how this unrolled to, for people in that situation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also they almost made it, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes. Yes. If the snow had come a few days later, they would have made it, and it was just random bad luck. But it's interesting what Gabrielle said about in the beginning it all seems almost like a summer vacation.
Yeah.
Although if you look at their journal entries during that time, they'll say things like, forded 32 creeks today. And it's clearly extremely strenuous, and there are rain and there's mosquitoes and all sorts of gnats and sunburn. It's not a summer vacation, but compared to what comes, it really is.
Even the way that they were sleeping with the, the nooning, Mom, and then they would stop and sleep in these wagons that were filled with their possessions, but you're sleeping on boards or you're sleeping in tents on the ground. It's not, you know, any of us who've gone camping know that that's not exactly wonderful traveling. And if you've been doing that for months on end, you know, you're hearing wolves at night, and there are a lot of strange things that would be, for people today, extremely difficult to even conceive of doing for a week long, let alone months. And then at the end, you're moving into territory that's completely unknown, and you're having to hack out a farm or something. So it's really fascinating to me, the drive that people had to find new adventure and how sturdy they were, what tough stock they were.
Yeah, I mean, there was, when I responded, Gabrielle, to your post earlier today, and I brought up, you know, when you were talking about how tough they were, and you know, comparing that to people today. I mean, Earth is pretty much a completely explored landscape for the most part, and I was thinking the only thing close to that would be some type of apocalyptic situation where people would have to go on a pilgrimage for survival into an unknown. But I mean, do you think that do you think we could adapt to that pretty quickly and be able to tolerate that terrain?
Oh, I think Americans are tremendously tough. If we're asked, you know, if we're challenged, I think the problem is that we're not particularly challenged to do anything except on a personal level. And let me say that when you say, you're talking about apocalypse and the road, but think of people in the Congo today. Think of Libya right now.
Sure.
Think of all the countries. It's always seemed kind of weird to me that we have such a fascination with TV reality shows that we make up things to survive when there's so much in the world for so many people to survive. You know, I'm always thinking, why don't those people go to the Congo and help out there? But I think it's because people want a challenge. They want to watch somebody in extreme adversity and wonder if they could do that and how that person is doing. I think it's something people want to be as strong as they can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mean there are lots of shows like that, The Amazing Race or Survivor, stuff like that.
Yeah, and the ultimate, you know, the ultimate sports and all of that, that's all challenging oneself. And what's that about?
Yeah.
Marathons, you know, all those, what is it called, the Ironman, all those kind of things. People are pushing themselves to the limit, and you think at the time people were just doing this stuff as daily work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think it's interesting. I wanted to ask you, Mom, to tell the story of how you got into it. What drew you to this story in particular? Because I think that's, you know, a lot of people may want a challenge, you know, to push their yoga stretches a little further or to something like that. But, you know, to be drawn to something this, what other people would all say is bleak, this kind of story. What inspired you to follow it? I think that's a great.
Well, in 1972, I went to Bread Loaf Writers Conference, which is a wonderful two-week conference in Vermont. And at that time, I was a beginning writer, and I was writing poetry. And one day, one of the writers on the staff, who is well-known, his name was William Lederer, and he wrote The Ugly American. And he stopped me, and he said, I had a dream about you last night. I dreamt you were going to write about people eating each other to survive. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, most people eat each other to survive. You're going to write a book that shows a better way. And I said, well, how do I do that? And he said, well, how would I know? It's your book, not mine. Well, I had no idea what he was talking about. And he was very mysterious to me. I thought he was an old man. I see now he was 60. He had spent a lot of time in Asia. And he trafficked in the occult, like William Butler Yeats had. And he just had a kind of a spooky presence about him. However, I really respected him. And I just didn't understand what it meant. And I didn't tell anybody that he said it. I just went home and started a short story about a woman coming cross country on the back of her boyfriend's motorcycle. And that was my first short story, and I had done a lot of drafts when I realized that I didn't have any geography in it. And so I asked my husband, who had driven cross-country many times, to tell me what these people would see on the motorcycle. And he went very slowly, telling all of his memories, and I kind of zoned out a little bit. And at one point he said, well, they'd have to go over Donner Pass. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, you know, where they ate each other to survive. Now, my husband didn't know that William Lederer had said that. And just, I mean, I tell you, I woke up very, very quickly. I got out books on the Donner Party, and that was the first time I'd heard of them. And Tamsin Donner just leapt off the page. And then began a scant 38 years later, I published two books about them. And I would always be drawn back to her. I would do many other things, and then I'd go back to her. And I guess obsession would not be too strong a word.
What drew you to her, though? What do you think created that obsession, besides this thing, besides, you know, having someone say that to you? That's
well,
a lot of time.
Well, initially, because she had five daughters, and so did I. Now, two of hers were stepdaughters, but that didn't matter. That carried me a long time. It was during the women's movement, and everybody was looking for heroines for ourselves and for our daughters, and she was just a remarkable woman. She was a school teacher. She spoke French. She wrote poetry. Her art was much admired. She botanized. She had had a lot of tragedy in her early life and then came back from that, and she was just a terrific woman. For me, because she was a mother who had adventure, and I was a mother who wanted more adventure. I also had always been interested in survival stories, what we're talking about, wondering how I would fare in a similar situation. And that short story became a novel, and I wove a small fraction in it about Tamsin Donner. It was known in history that she kept a journal. So I had the woman on the back of the motorcycle find her journal in a rummage shop and be reading parts of it on the trip across country. which was basically a reversal of the Donner's trip. They were going from Berkeley to Buffalo. And there probably were, the novel was 550 pages, and probably 30 pages of it was about Tamsin Donner. But that, you know, she, again, I said she stayed with me. The novel did not stay with me after 7 years and numerous rejections, some encouragement, but in the end, you know, they wanted me to be a bridesmaid but not marry me. I put it in a drawer and I started another novel, and I left it there for a good many years.
What do you think, why do you think people were rejecting it? Do you think it was that you hadn't completed the full arc of what you needed for the novel? It wasn't there, or was it just not the right
time? I think that I didn't have the skills. It was probably the major thing. I mean, here I chose a topic. I have two people on the back of a motorcycle, and you can't talk on a motorcycle because it's so noisy. So, you know, I had flashbacks within flashbacks within flashbacks, and I had the modern story in third person, and I had the Tamsin Donner section in first person. I was trying to do a lot of things that I simply didn't have the writing skills to do, and I would devise more and more and more, you know, ways to get out of this, but it really was just kind of a mishmash, although there were a lot of things in it that I was encouraged by, you know, for, but in the end, I think it was mainly technical.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have to say, when I did ultimately go back to it and concentrate on Tamsin Donner, and I was a completely different person, it was a completely different book.
Yeah.
Does anything remain from that book, do you feel, or is it just totally a reinterpretation? Or?
Well, from the modern part, I worked out a lot of those things in a much more efficient way in my novel Heartbreak Hotel. But the part about Tamsin, very, very, maybe a sentence here or there, but very little of that remained.
Obviously, all the research that you did, though, prepared you, and yet that continued. And I think one thing that's really interesting is how you're researching this as a personal or artistic passion kind of made you an expert on the Donner Party. I don't know if you'd say that, but... it seems like you are someone who knows a lot more than many people about it, and then that led you to the letters at the Huntington?
Yeah. Well, because I was trying to be a writer while being a mother, and I was so interested in Tamsin Donner, I took you and your sisters and my husband every place that Tamsin Donner had been. And she really kind of became an integral part of our family. We went to Newburyport, Massachusetts, where she had been born, and we went to Elizabeth City, North Carolina, where she had married her first husband and lost her first husband and two children in a three-month period. We camped on her and George Donner's farm in Illinois. We spent an entire summer retracing the California-Oregon Trail. Our dog was named Tamsin. She was really very much a part of our family. And after I put that novel away, that first novel, and went on to other things, in 95, I was at American Film Institute. I was there in 95 to 97, but in the summer of 96, there was the Donner Party sesquicentennial at Donner Pass, and my kids said, well, of course you're going. And I said, no, I'm not going. And they and my husband badgered me and said, you know, we grew up with Tamsin Donner. You had us go every place Tamsin Donner did. You're living in California. You have to go to the sesquicentennial. So I did go, and I didn't want to go. It brought back all those rejections, and the whole subject was aversive to me. And I really thought I had forgotten everything that I knew. But when I got there, by the second day, I realized that, you know, I was one of the few people, if only person, who had retraced the entire trail. And I was the only one that had slept on their farm. And I was the only one who had a dog named Tamsin, et cetera. I really did realize that I knew a great deal about the Donner Party. And when I went back to school, I wrote a screenplay about the Donner Party. It had, there were 87 characters. So that was another kind of evolution of the material, where originally I was trying to write always about all the people, and every one of them has an incredible story. Mm-hmm. And it took some years for me to discover that what I was really interested in was Tamsin Donner and her spirit. And so I concentrated on her.
And how, I mean, speak when you bring up the screenplay and whatnot, I mean, how cinematic do you think that is? I mean,
I think it's fantastic. I think it's one of the great American adventures and also American tragedy. It's a small event in American history, but it has never, ever lost its hold on people's imagination,
mm-hmm.
because it is, as I said before, it's the American dream gone sour, gone nightmare. And people want to know, you know, what happened there in those 4.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic movie.
I've read the script, and as a filmmaker, I can say it's an amazing movie. What's so interesting about this story, and I think so compelling also, is that it's not just a cowboy western. It's a family story. And so you have, I mean, how many westerns have we seen where a mother is the central character? And that's really something that's not just unique, but extremely compelling emotionally, especially in a world when, with most movies, you sort of feel like, oh, I've seen that movie already. This is something that's so different. And I think it speaks to a lot of people's experience even today, because I know as a parent of young children that it's really a struggle to balance the desire for adventure and to continue to sort of stretch yourself and find freedom and yet be a parent also and be a good parent, you know, the best you can be to your children. And I think that's something that really touches people about Tamsin Donner's story and then her lifelong strong love with her husband George Donner and the unusually equal relationship that they had as a couple, you know, where she was very strong within that couple. She wasn't just subservient to him, and they both really planned for the trip together, and they were planning to start a new life together with their children to make a better life for their children. So I think all of those things resonate to people's struggles nowadays and their interests and their passions. And it's, you know, so it's not just the Western aspect of it, but it's a family story, it's a parenting story, and it's a love story, which is pretty neat, wrapped into one.
Yeah.
Of course, then you have the tragedy. So it's sort of like Titanic, you know, where it has the love story and everything, and you know it's going to end badly, so you're sitting there sobbing, you know.
But the thing is that, you know, it's a tragedy without a tragic flaw. I mean, they did not do anything wrong.
Yeah.
They
mm-hmm.
had bad luck, and they took a shortcut, but the man who said told about the shortcut had written a book that was published, and, you know, people talked about it all the time and debated it, and paper, it looked fantastic. It turned out that the man had never been over that, and it cost them a month of travel where they had to actually hack out their own road through the Wasatch Mountains in Utah. And that was unfortunate. They lost time when they stopped to bury their dead, but they were civilized people, and they were taking their civilization with them. I mean, they were certainly going to stop and bury their dead. And then the snows came early. So it's a tragedy, but they didn't do anything wrong. That's what is really a very, very interesting thing about that story, because it could have happened to anybody.
And
they were
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say they were also very well prepared. I mean, they had three wagons. The Donners were well-off people. They certainly didn't need to go to California, but they wanted to go to California, and they prepared for months, and they had a lot of, you know, they were well prepared, and then many things happened, and one by one, the provisions dwindled away, and anyway.
Well,
you said something about the idea of the world all being mapped now, and so everything's sort of known, And yet I was just reading an article that said that Google Maps is so well known now that that actually could be contributing to some of the unrest in the Middle East, because people can see what territory is taken by whom and where there is open land, which is a very interesting new idea of people, you know, finding open land and finding opportunity by looking to a map source, where at the time they, you know, had the best thing they could. And yet, 150 years ago, people just didn't know all this territory, so you'd think you were going into something, and it could be something completely different, which is what happened to the Donners.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason for them not to, to trust that map, it seems. But, all you know, the thing that I keep thinking about this is that bad things happen to good people sometimes, and that's just, that's a part of the American dream and just humanity itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And
but
if we didn't have that risk. I'm sorry to you know, over that, but if we didn't have that risk, then you know, what would we, what really would we be searching for?
Right, right. Well, if you look at maps at that time, there's this great big section out in the middle of it that says wilderness, and you think, oh my golly, how would you ever start out like that? And they had little rough maps that people had sent back, and you know, the emigration started in 1841, and this was 1846, and and the wagons had gone the year before, so they knew it would be tough. They knew, they figured it would be a 6-month trip, but they also knew wagons could do it. And it was interesting that Tamsin and George were old for the trail. He was 62 and she was 45. And it was mostly a young person's game, but they thought it would be advantageous for them and for their children. And they also were that kind of, they were those kind of people that they had emigrated all their life. They had kept moving and moving and moving, and they wanted to see what was there. And like you're saying, you know, if people hadn't taken that risk, well, we'd never have anything new.
Yeah, absolutely. That's weird. I have you guys seen that miniseries documentary, The Journey of Man?
No.
Where it traces civilization by DNA from Africa, and how they got to, how explorers got to Australia, and really why we have different ethnicities. And
it should be called The Journey of Humans, of course.
Yeah.
I don't think man could have made it without woman.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that they bring up is when people came from Central Asia through northeastern Russia, what's now Russia, and, you know, there was a drought that allowed people to cross over into what's now Alaska and down into what's now the United States. But it's suspected that it's less than a party of less than 4 to 10 survivors that actually made it through there. And, you know, what would life be like now if they hadn't?
Right,
I mean, just those you know, less than a dozen people. So
yeah.
When I was watching that, I thought a lot about your book because, you know, I mean, of course, there were lots of other people pioneering the West, but, you know, I mean, when information got through about the cannibalism and really blew things up, you know, I think that put a spotlight more on the struggle. Where would we be today if that story hadn't gone out?
I think an interesting corollary to that is that people feel, you know, there but for the grace go I, because that's the other part why the cannibalism, I think, speaks to people so much. And I talk to people about this because obviously I grew up with this story, and to me it was just sort of a story. It's one of the many stories. I mean, you know, now there are all the Hans Christian Andersen stories. I mean, things that are much more gruesome or sort of horrific. And this had the aspect where this was a family that was sticking together and was surviving together. And I think it's very interesting how the young men died first, whereas the families survived. And I think that speaks a lot about sort of human compassion and connection and how important it is for people to survive, is to be able to have that sense of you know, love and family when they're under these horrific circumstances.
Yeah, they had people to care for and people to stay alive for and people to also help stay alive. And it's, you know, it's Barbara Streisand, people need people. it's an interesting thing, though, that that's something in our society where we've always had that conflict between individualism versus community. You know, we have the whole Western myth is very much around self-reliance and the single gun. And when they formed parties for safety, but when the going got rough out there, it broke into individual family groups, and the young single men died at twice the rate of family men.
That's amazing. I think that's also something where people look at them and say, oh, well, I would never do that, or they'd be horrified by it, right? And yet we don't really know what we do when we're tested and what kind of personality we would be. I was saying to my mom that I just was taking out the trash early this morning, and it's cold. I'm in Ohio, and it's cold, and it's really heavy, and I just getting it across this huge lawn, I was just complaining to myself, and I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, how quickly one can adjust to circumstances and be sort of wimpy in the face. You know, I think of myself as pretty strong stock, and here I was sort of with this perspective, you know, complaining about this heavy load I was carrying. And then I was thinking of those people who were carrying children through huge snowdrifts, and, you know, they themselves must have been freezing and wet, and, you know, they're malnourished for months, and they're trying to get out of there, and they're carrying, you know, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old. That's extraordinary that people were able to do that. So
yeah,
it doesn't surprise me they'd have to turn to any way to survive.
Well, they did eat everything else that was possible. I mean, they basically stayed alive on boiled oxen skins. And, you know, they tried to do hunting. They didn't have too much success at that. They ate the bones of the oxen. They ate bark off the trees. They had a lot of the cattle had run off in the snow, and they just constantly tried to find those cattle. They stuck long poles in the snow with nails on the end to try to grab the hare, and they never found one. And they gave the children twigs to try to, you know, staunch their hunger. And they ate their dogs. I mean, they ate shoelaces. Eventually, there was just nothing left. And would you let your children starve? I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know, it would be, in one instance, and that was out when the party tried to walk over the mountains, in one instance, two Indians were killed for food. But before the whole rest of the party back in the camps, they only ate dead people. Nobody killed anybody, you know, for food. And that just seems like a no-brainer to me, that you would use the dead to keep the living alive. I mean, it would be so weird to just honor the dead to that extent that you would die yourself and watch your children die.
Yeah, I mean, put in a perspective like that you know, it doesn't, it makes it seem a lot more, you know, much of a reality where you'd be able to do that. I think a lot of people would look at it and go, you know, no matter what situation I'm in, I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if my body could physically, if I could swallow that without regurgitating it or whatever. But when you bring in the idea that that's what you have to do to let your children survive or have you around to take care of them, I mean, it's a whole different ballgame. It really comes down to, do you murder people or do you just eat dead people?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
And if,
yeah.
I don't know. But,
and you have situations throughout history with shipwrecked sailors where they would draw lots when everybody was starving.
Oh, yeah.
And that was called the custom of the sea, because they were exempt in maritime law because of their circumstances. But the custom of the sea was to draw lots, kill somebody, and eat them. Otherwise, everybody would die.
Yeah, yeah. But that, I mean, that in that situation, it's voluntary, right?
Well, we can
sure.
only hope.
Who knows?
You know, that's the sort of thing. Well, if you draw lots, it's not really. I mean, what if you get the short stick? You know, you're going to say, no, 2 out of 3.
You say 2 out of funk.
Yeah.
I also think there are probably, a number of people that were relieved to get picked because it would be the end of their suffering as well. Bringing in the whole psychological aspect of things. I mean, I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
I don't know. I don't think anybody would be once they're at that moment. You know, I think the human survival instinct's so strong. I do think, though, what's interesting is, going back to the single men dying and stuff, I think that there were people who just sort of gave up the ghost, just lay down and died.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating. You know, that's where I think, gosh, what would I do? Would I be one of those people who would just lay down and despair? Or would I be a Tamsin Donner who would just keep going and going and, take bark off of the trees and make pulp for the children to eat out of, out of oxen hide? And I don't know how I would do in that. So it's not really an issue of, the dying as much, of the cannibalism part of it as much as, is it within oneself to really try to survive and try to find ways to keep your spirits up.
Mm-hmm. Well,
one thing about those men, that they were the young men, they were physically exhausted from all of that hacking out that road in the Wasatch Mountains, and that's probably part of what contributed also to their decision. But again, they didn't have anybody to say, get up, or here's some food, or go find me some food.
I think the biggest thing can be somebody that they had to take care of, because that's where it comes down with what you're saying, Tyson, is that if you're having to be a parent of somebody and that person's relying on you, you're going to get up because they don't have anybody to do it for them.
Yeah.
And that will create a lot of strength in someone to just find other resources.
And there were people that did get out. Gabrielle, can you just talk briefly on some of the descendants or what actually happened after that and where it led to today?
Well, there were 87 in the Donner Party, but of 6 of them, various things happened to them along the way. So there were 81 who were trapped. Of those 81, 41 were children 14 and under, and that was one of the real problems because rescue parties came in, but the first rescue party was only 7 men, and the second rescue party was small also. All the rescue parties were actually small, and there were just too few rescuers for too many children. The children, a lot of them couldn't walk. They had to be carried. There was one rescuer, John Stark, who was apparently this huge man, but he just relayed the children. He would take a child, walk 20 feet in the snow, put the child down, go back, get another one, and all the way 100 miles until they were out.
Incredible.
Now, some people died during the rescues because they were so far, and again, the rescuers had very little food. But about half of the party managed to get to California, not Tamsin Donner or her husband George, but their 5 daughters. And at the Donner Party sesquicentennial, I mean, there were some hundreds of descendants who came. I don't know how many there are. I've heard from several since my book has come out, and they're all very proud of being, descendants of. And even the daughters who had a really sad childhood because they were shunted around a lot and separated for 15 years. They grew up and became first citizens of California, and they had many children among them, and they all lived to be in their 80s and 90s. This was all pre-Freudian times, and it doesn't mean that people didn't suffer, because I'm sure they suffered tremendously. But there wasn't really a language for that kind of suffering the way there is today.
Yeah.
I wanted to sort of ask a question, Mom, and I think one thing that we're... Tyson, is that all right?
Mm-hmm, of course, yeah.
I think one of the things that we'd be interested in hearing from listeners and from people in part of the book club is their thoughts on, you know, what they draw from the book and all of these things of what would they do if they were tested, or does this bring up, you know, issues of self-reflection? I think that'd be very interesting for people to talk about that and what the book makes them think about it. I wanted to ask Mom a question, actually, a little bit along those lines of when you're, as a writer, putting yourself into that character because it's done in the first, well, rather because you're investing yourself in writing the book, and you chose to do it in the first person perspective, and I wondered, two questions, I guess. Did you, because it's a work of fiction and there were certain historical documents that you're drawing from her voice and other things that were known about her, but you had to invent certain things, how did you create that whole character? Does an author put themselves into it, or did you feel at all that you had to do that? And then why choose the first-person perspective?
A lot of questions there, Gabrielle.
Sorry. Well, there was somebody
that
asked me.
Let's pick one of them
because
we have a caller on the line.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well, a reader had asked me about the first person, so answer that one.
Mainly I did the first person because Tamsin Donner kept a journal. It's known that historically that journal was lost, and I always thought of Impatient with Desire as being her lost journal, and she, of course, would write in the first person. You want to take a question, Tyson, or?
Yeah. Let's bring somebody on here. Hey, you there? Caller?
Hello? Yes. Hi.
Hey. How's it going?
Hi.
What's your name?
How's it going?
It's going well. Who is this?
Telly Davidson.
Oh, great, Telly. Well, welcome to the show.
Likewise.
Do you have a question for our author?
I was just wanting to hear more about some of the research process that she put in on this. Did you talk to family members or track down friends and that type of thing? You could say ancestors. Or how much of this was done in... done going through documents, going through the internet? What was your main mode of research?
Not talking to descendants. I didn't meet descendants until after the books were published. Mainly just research in books, and then I was lucky enough to have access to Tamsin Donner's letters, and there's 17 of those. And they gave me part of the voice and filled in some blanks that I didn't know. And then the other thing was just... constantly reading. There are many, many, many books on the Oregon Trail and the California Trail, and then during that period in the mid-1800s, what life was like, just plain old research. And then at a certain point, I mean, what people really want to know is what really happened there in the mountains, and nobody knows that. You have to imagine it. I was lucky to write a nonfiction book before the novel called Searching for Tamsin Donner, which was the story of looking for her and trying to discover her. And it's a little more complicated than that. But I was lucky that I did the nonfiction book first because I used all the facts in there that I could find. And then in the novel, you know, I still used some of those, but it had to go into the imagination. You don't know that. Nobody will know that.
And one other thing, if I may, how long did it take for the people to sort of, I hate to use the word, but sort of revert before they, what was that process like? I mean, you don't do what they did lightly. Some people would rather starve to death themselves than even to kill a dog or a cat for food or something. What was that process like, do you think, for the people who did what they did?
Well, they were in three different camps, and the Donner family themselves with some Teamsters. They were 6 miles east of the other two camps because they had had an accident with their wagon going up the mountain, and so they were behind when the snow came. All of them, the first, they were stopped, let's say, October 31st, and the first rescue party came in February 17th. So you're talking November, December, January, and half of February, that there had been no cannibalism up to that point. It started after that first rescue party because there was no more food. When those rescuers came in fact, some of them crept out in the night and ate their shoelaces, the leather shoelaces. Now, in December, a group left. There were 12 men and 7 women, I think, went out. They're called now the Forlorn Hope. But they were people who went out to walk over the mountains to try to bring back help. They thought it would take them 6 days. It took them 30 days, and half of them died. That was the first instance that you had cannibalism. The people back in the camps didn't know anything about that, but that's the first place. That was also the place where one crazed man killed 2 Indians who had actually been sent in earlier along the trail to rescue them. Captain Sutter had sent them in, and they were ultimately killed.
I see. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, Telly, real quick, I saw that you just sent in a posting to the book club about Westerns in film, and we were just talking about a little bit of the screenplay, and you mentioned True Grit, and I think this is a good segue to go into one of the things that has just happened with Gabrielle in the book, which she has been awarded with the Western Heritage Award for Outstanding Western Novel by the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum. Congratulations again on that. And I also got a post that the Coen brothers might show up because they won an award too.
Awesome.
Well, I don't know if they're going to be there. True Grit did win the movie, and
yeah.
You know, somebody will be there from True Grit, but
somebody.
We hope it's the Coen brothers. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Telly, it looks like you're a film guy. I mean, what do you think, how do you think Tamsin Donner and the story of the Donner Party would go over on the big screen?
Oh, I think it would be a fantastic thing. If it was done with the right amount of balance of sort of taste and the sort of a visceral look at these people, sort of the way 127 Hours was, or the way There Will Be Blood was, where it was, where you could sort of see, it didn't sort of excuse what went on, but where it could sort of seek to explain it, where you could really, if it was really intimate and really got into the characters. Again, I think it would, and showed what the psychological transformation was for that group of people. I think it would make a tremendous film.
Was that an intentional pun, saying skin there?
Well, no,
it was
not intentional.
I think it's interesting.
I totally agree with you. I think there have been some films, nonfiction films, a documentary made about the Donner Party, and there's one pretty good doc, but basically they all make too much of the cannibalism while not really getting it at all. And when you talk about that, you know, the psychological and the physical conditions, everything that leads you up to that, one thing that's very gratifying to me as a writer is that a lot of people have told me that after they read Impatient with Desire that, you know, they had been repulsed by cannibalism before, and then they just see the inevitability of it. And they also see these people as real. And, of course, you would see that on the screen, too. You know, they've been reduced to kind of a morbid joke, but they are real people and who went through tremendous adversity. And many of them behaved very, very well. And even those who didn't, I mean, they all have paved the way for us. But anyway, I totally agree with you is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, how gruesome do you think you can get? I mean, you would have to show something, otherwise people...
Well,
you know.
My feeling, if I can pipe in, is that, you know, there are these things where people make horror movies or whatever. I don't think that's what it's about at all. And I say this as somebody who, I mean, pretty much this was my whole lifetime. My mom was researching this stuff, and we were traveling around to these various places. And so this is very much sort of my whole lore growing up. And the cannibalism is an extremely small part of it. Really what's extraordinary and the tragedy of it is these people losing their lives. And this, you know, this it's the great American dream gone wrong. And everybody in their life faces some point when they are, you know, having a challenge or they take on a challenge, and it either goes great or it goes very south. And in this case, you know, this is something where the whole way along there are all of these things happening where people die along the way, or there are accidents that happen, and you just can't even imagine the hardship that these people face going across the Great Salt Lake Desert. It's an extraordinary part of the story, and they're having to abandon most of their possessions just in the desert, and you just imagine these people leaving precious things that they can't imagine leaving behind them, but they do. And every one of those choices strips them down further and further to what sort of really matters, and then you're just down to simply living. And that's I think, what is the extraordinary part of the story, not the cannibalism. It's really about the human spirit and the survival of the human spirit and all the people who made it. They did save their five daughters. All of those girls
lived.
True.
Well, who could handle this? I don't want to, you know, get too much like Entertainment Tonight here, but it's like who could handle a story like that?
I don't know. Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks. There's probably a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
Do you think Steven Spielberg could pull off something that's good, that does that justifies the story in this?
Sure. I mean, I don't know that he has the interest, but yeah, he did Schindler's List. I mean, that's a fantastic film.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people who could, as long as you didn't get into what Gabrielle's talking about with, you know, there was a movie recently where, a horror movie where they have George Donner, it's a modern day movie, but George Donner and all of them are ghouls and come to, you know, suck their blood. And this sort of thing is so ridiculous and offensive to me, but also these people just don't even have any understanding of what that story is about. And, you know, you don't move away from the cannibalism because that's certainly part of it, but it's just one part of it.
I mean, I think there could be a lot of people and they would all have different sort of takes on it. Someone like Catherine Bigelow could be really interesting as a director because she's obviously made War, you know, something that was very complex and made people think about it too. So there are a lot of ways that having a male director or a female director could be, you know, really interesting on this project.
My daughters are filmmakers and wonderful filmmakers, and they know this story as well as I do, and they've lived with it their whole lives. And if somebody gave them some money, believe me, they'd be making that movie in a minute. As far as what people put into movies, it wouldn't cost that much.
Yeah.
You know, but it's more than they have.
Yeah, I guess,
so if there's anybody out there wanting to
invest
in a movie, please call.
This is a good one. Well, I mean, is it? I haven't read the script, but is it pretty isolated as far as? I mean, are they on the trail, or are they? Do you seamlessly weave in backstory of her earlier life?
Yeah.
It's basically in that. It's similar to the novel, wouldn't you say, Mom?
Yeah.
Well, they are trapped, but then it goes back.
And it keeps, figuring out how.
And actually, it has a very hopeful ending.
Which is hard to do with the Donner Party, but it is. And again, that's what I say. I mean, the thing to focus on is that they did save five children. You know, they saved all of their children.
George and Tamsin.
George and Tamsin, and I think that that's extraordinary. I mean, just body-wise, to have little tiny children that could easily die in such circumstances, and they were able to get them out. And those people lived extremely long lives and had many, many grandchildren and many people who are still around today.
And talking about the movie, here Tamsin Donner was confronted with a decision where her husband was dying. When they were going up that mountain, an axle broke, and when he and his brother were fixing it, a chisel slipped and gashed his hand, and that wound ultimately killed him. So he's dying all the time that they're there, and she gets the children out, but she makes the decision to stay with her husband until death do them part, and that becomes a fatal decision for her. Now, I wouldn't want to be faced with that decision, my husband or my children, but she was. It was just one more awful decision that she was faced with.
Above everything, if you're not a part of this book group and you're just chiming in, the book is Impatient with Desire, The Lost Journal of Tamsin Donner, available in hardcover now. The paperback comes out March 15th. And thanks, Telly. Thanks for calling in. Hopefully we'll see you on the message board.
Sure.
Yeah, we should definitely invite people to be part of the Facebook group, Impatient with Desire Facebook group, and also then join the Goodreads Impatient with Desire group, and if you're part of the pre-publication book club now, you know, post messages, and we love hearing people's thoughts about the book and getting conversations going. So
exactly, and that's all happening at goodreads.com. And again, if you have any questions or you're trying to get on the group but you can give us a call here at 213-623-1773 or email us at info@rarebirdlit.com. It looks like we're running out of time here, so I do want to say thanks to both of you for coming on the show, and thanks for Telly calling in, and we're going to be doing this next week, and then the third broadcast is going to be on publication date, which is Tuesday, March 15th. So thank you both for coming on, and then we'll see you all on the message boards, all right?
All right. Great. You're welcome. And just one last thing.
Yes.
We have to honor the people whose shoulders we stand on. If we forget all the people who sacrificed before us, I mean, that cheapens our accomplishments. Mm-hmm. We're only able to do things because somebody else made it possible. And I really want, you know, they're part of the people that should be honored. So
that's
the end for me.
I think you do that in the book. I think that it's really something that is accomplished, and I'm very thankful, having lived it, that you're then translated in this very artistic way. It's a beautiful accomplishment, if I can say.
Well, that's a fantastic way to end the discussion, right? So anyway, check out the book, and we'll talk to you all next time. Thanks for listening.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Left you on a debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting through the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. Top of the stairs. trouble at the depot with the general workers union. And yet they'll never change a thing.